Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with Alice Bryant and Jill Robbins. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, an aid group called Operation Smile has been helping people born with cleft lips and cleft palates for over 30 years. The group, based in the United States, works in countries around the world. In the African nation of Malawi, Operation Smile's medical team operates on babies affected by a cleft lip or palate for free. Many parents there feel embarrassed if their child is born with either condition. Agnes Chiocha is from Malawi. She gave birth to a son with a cleft lip last year. Chiocha says she was overcome with emotion and wondered why she had given birth to such a child. In Chiocha's home village, people began to say that her child's cleft lip resulted from a failed abortion. They claimed that she had asked a doctor to end the pregnancy. Others accused her of using birth control methods that deformed her baby. Chiocha says she denied that any kind of birth control was involved. She said that God created her boy with a cleft lip. Operation Smile says cleft lips and palates are the world's third most common birth defect. They reportedly affect one out of every 750 babies. In Malawi, Operation Smile has performed 1,000 surgical operations over the past 7 years. But the group heavily depends on foreign doctors because few local plastic surgeons are available. Ibrahim Natalika is program manager for Operation Smile, Malawi.
We have only two plastic surgeons that volunteer to work with us, that can do this and volunteer to work with us.
People born with a cleft lip or palate may have difficulty speaking and eating. They also face unkind treatment and discrimination, like the kind James Rice experienced. Rice says his aunt insulted him a lot. He says she told him that if he had been born when she was there, she would have thrown him away into the toilet. But those who receive the operation have reason to smile. Agnes Chiocha says now those who used to insult her will feel guilty once they see her child had an operation. James Rice says now he will be able to do everything without any problem and will not feel badly as before. He adds that he can now tell others who have clefts to have their defect repaired. Operation Smile estimates that 3,000 people in Malawi still suffer from cleft lips or palates. The group is now training local doctors to perform the operation.
Thank you. people who have repeatedly changing sleep and wake times and get different amounts of sleep each night are more likely to have metabolic health conditions. That is the finding of a new study. For years, lack of sleep has been linked to a wide collection of metabolic conditions, including obesity, high blood pressure, and diabetes. But until the recent study, health researchers did not know much about the effects of inconsistent sleep, including nightly changes in sleep amount and timing. Tianyi Wang is among the writers of the study. Huang is with the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School in Boston. In an email to Reuters news agency, Huang said that more inconsistent sleep times are associated with higher metabolic disease risk. And that is no matter if one has short or long sleep duration, or has good or poor sleep quality. The researcher explained that night-to-night differences in sleep, either duration or timing, are associated with high risk of having several metabolic problems at the same time. Huang added that these effects cannot be avoided by having a longer sleep duration on some nights. For the study, 2,003 patients did home-based sleep studies for 1 week. They used devices known as actigraphs, which measure nighttime movements and sleep-wake cycles. The study was published in Diabetes Care. On average, these people got about 7.15 hours of sleep each night and went to bed at around 11:40 p.m. Around two-thirds of them had more than 1 hour of change in sleep duration, and 45% of them had more than 1 hour of change in their bedtimes. A total of 707 patients, or 35%, had metabolic syndrome, several types of metabolic problems that increase heart disease risks. They included increased blood pressure, high blood sugar, more fat around the stomach, and abnormal levels of some body chemicals. Compared to people who had less than 1 hour of change in sleep duration, people whose sleep duration changed by 60 to 90 minutes were 27% more likely to have metabolic syndrome. The increase rose to 41% for people with 90 to 120 minutes of change in sleep duration. It rose to 57% with more than 2 hours of change in sleep duration.
Compared with people with no more than half an hour of change in their nightly bedtime, people whose bedtime changed by 30 to 60 minutes were similarly associated with metabolic syndrome. But it was 14% higher when bedtimes changed by 60 to 90 minutes. It was 58% higher when bedtimes changed by more than 90 minutes. The study was not designed to prove whether or how changes in sleep duration or bedtimes might cause metabolic syndrome. Instead, it showed an association between inconsistent sleep behavior and metabolic diseases. Kristen Knutson is a researcher at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. She said the reason high inconsistency in sleep affects metabolic health may be about our biological clocks. Knutson was not involved in the study. She said in an email that the human body has 24-hour rhythms, and these rhythms must work together and with the environment for good health. If a person sleeps at different times and different amounts, she said, The body's clocks may have difficulty staying synchronized, which may lead to harm. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
When educators think of literacy, the ability to read and write, they often place more importance on students' abilities to read and fully understand a piece of writing. But experts say critical and creative writing skills are equally important, and they say they are too often overlooked in the classroom. Compared to reading, writing is more active. It helps students be independent thinkers, take ownership of their stories and ideas, and communicate them clearly to others, says Elise Eidman-Adol. She heads the National Writing Project, which offers help for teachers who want to push students to write more. Eidman-Adol said, "Unless we want an education system just focused on making people consumers and not focused on helping them be producers, this emphasis on reading only, which does happen in so many places, is very short-sighted." She said students' writing work now usually centers on examining a text instead of presenting a new idea. Writing, she said, should be the central thing you're learning. Not writing on a test, not writing to demonstrate you're learning what someone has taught you. Teaching reading, together with writing, improves both skills, says Rebecca Wallace Segal, who heads a New York City writing center, Writopia Lab. She said writing affects a person's ability to read. More than 90% of young people in the Writopia program do not trust their writing abilities when they start, Wallace Segal said. But she said they learn to enjoy the writing process and become more effective readers, too. Eidman-Adol said employers today seek workers all the time who can write well. Digital tools increasingly mean that people are interacting with the internet through writing, she said. Young people are already writing all the time, through text messages, emails, and on social media. Eidman-Adol said every young person today is a writer if they are connected to the internet. So, she added, we have to help them do it in the best, most responsible, critical, pro-social way. Supporters of writing-centered teaching add that writing empowers young people. When students own their voices and tell their stories, they become not only stronger and more confident writers, but also stronger and more confident individuals, says Ali Haider. He is director of the Austin Bat Cave, a creative writing center in Austin, Texas. Wallace Segal said that writing also helps students work through difficulties they face in life. Writing lets them work through their problems subconsciously, she said. They are not writing a story about a difficult father or directly about a bully in class, but they are creating a fictional scenario that might feel distant enough for them to go deep into it. Teaching students to write well can have an effect on the larger world, notes Dara Dukes. She leads Deep Center, an organization in Savannah, Georgia, that works with young writers to share their stories with policymakers, judges, politicians, and police officers. Dukes said, "Those adults can see that the stories they're telling themselves about those young people are often wrong and doing a lot of harm in the world."
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
A stunning and cowardly strike on the United States. The president vows the killers will pay for this attack on America.
The United States changed as a result of the September 11th terrorist attacks. CBS newsman Dan Rather expressed what many Americans were feeling.
You will remember this day as long as you live.
On the morning of that sunny September day that came to be known as 9/11, the nation came under attack from Al-Qaeda, an extremist group led by Osama bin Laden. Its targets were world-famous buildings representing America's economic and military power. Al-Qaeda operatives hijacked four American passenger airplanes. The hijackers were from Middle Eastern countries. Each group included a pilot trained to fly two kinds of Boeing airliners, the 757 and the 767. At 8:46 on that morning, one group of hijackers flew a Boeing 767 into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York City. 17 minutes later, another group flew a second 767 into the Trade Center's South Tower. The planes exploded in fireballs that sent clouds of smoke into the air. The intense heat of the burning jet fuel from the planes caused structural failures that brought down both buildings. About an hour after the first plane hit the World Trade Center, another group of Al-Qaeda operatives flew a 757 airliner into the Pentagon, the headquarters of the Defense Department in Arlington, Virginia. The plane exploded against a wall of the huge building where more than 20,000 people worked. A fourth group had taken control of another 757, but some of the passengers on that flight, United 93, had heard about the terrorist attacks through phone calls to their families. Several passengers and crew members attempted to retake control of the plane. It crashed near the town of Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Investigators later said the hijackers probably planned to attack the Capitol, a major government building in Washington, D.C., where Congress meets. There was also concern that the White House could have been a target. The 9/11 attacks saw the worst loss of lives on American soil since Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941. That attack caused the United States to enter World War II.
The pictures of airplanes flying into buildings, fires burning, huge structures collapsing, have filled us with disbelief, terrible sadness, and a quiet, unyielding anger.
As expressed by President George W. Bush on 9/11, the attacks left Americans in a state of shock and disbelief. But that was soon replaced by anger and a resolve that such events would not be allowed to happen again.
These acts of mass murder were intended to frighten our nation into chaos and retreat. But they have failed. Our country is strong. A great people has been moved to defend a great nation. Terrorist attacks can shake the foundations of our biggest buildings, but they cannot touch the foundation of America. These acts shatter steel, but they cannot dent the steel of American resolve.
At Ground Zero, the site of the World Trade Center destruction, rescue efforts continued into the night. New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani was asked if Arab American or Muslim groups in New York might be targeted due to the nature of the attacks.
Just the opposite. They will receive extra protection. The particular individuals responsible and the groups responsible, that's up to law enforcement, and it's up to the United States government to figure out. And citizens of New York should, even if they have anger, which is understandable, it isn't their place to get involved in this. Then they're just participating in the kind of activity we just witnessed. And New Yorkers are not like that.
And Giuliani spoke of the strength of spirit of the people of his city.
People tonight should say a prayer for the people that we've lost and be grateful that we're all here. And tomorrow, New York is going to be here, and we're going to rebuild, and we're going to be stronger than we were before.
On September 20th, President Bush went before a joint session of Congress to declare a war on terror.
Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated.
President Bush explained that the war on terror would be different from other wars.
Our response involves far more than instant retaliation and isolated strikes. Americans should not expect one battle, but a lengthy campaign, unlike any other we have ever seen. We will starve terrorists of funding, turn them one against another, drive them from place to place until there is no refuge or no rest. And we will pursue nations that provide aid or safe haven to terrorism. Every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. From this day forward, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime.
President Bush demanded that the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan stop sheltering Osama bin Laden and surrender him. The president also called on the Taliban to close terrorist training camps in Afghanistan. The Taliban refused. They demanded evidence that Osama bin Laden had been involved in the attacks of 9/11. They said that if such evidence was provided, he would be tried in an Islamic court. The United States refused to provide evidence. On October 7th, the United States and Britain launched airstrikes against Taliban targets. What became known as the War on Terror had begun. Tribal groups from the opposition Northern Alliance led a ground attack. But suicide bombers had killed their leader, Ahmad Shah Massoud, on September 9th, 2 days before the 9/11 attacks. By November, Taliban control began to collapse in several provinces. Taliban forces fled Kabul, the capital. But the ouster of the Taliban government did not mean the end of the war on terror. Some of President Bush's advisors had long supported an invasion of Iraq. As early as October 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld suggested that military action against Iraq was possible. Government officials accused Iraq of having links to terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. They noted that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons, and they said he was seeking to develop biological and nuclear weapons as well. In October 2001, Congress passed the USA Patriot Act. This law provided the government with more power to gather information about suspected terrorists in the United States. Critics said the law invaded constitutional rights to privacy. Civil liberties groups said the Patriot Act gave law enforcement and other agencies too much power. In January 2002, President Bush gave his State of the Union report to Congress. He accused some nations of supporting terrorist organizations. He said the United States would not wait to be attacked by such groups. Instead, it would strike first at the countries that sheltered them. The president identified three nations, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, as supporters of terror.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger. They could provide these arms to terrorists, giving them the means to match their hatred.
In 2002, the United States opened a detention center at its naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Some of the fighters arrested in Afghanistan were sent there. They were not considered prisoners of war. Instead, the detainees were treated as unlawful enemy combatants. As such, the Bush administration said they did not have the same rights as war prisoners under international treaties. In the United States, the government also detained some foreign citizens, mostly for violating immigration laws. No terrorism charges were brought against these detainees. Human rights activists and some legal experts protested the detentions. After 9/11, government agencies were criticized for failing to prevent the terrorist attacks. Critics said the agencies should have been working together to gather intelligence. Government officials said part of the issue involved legal restrictions on the gathering and sharing of intelligence. In January 2003, the Department of Homeland Security opened for business.
Maybe you see something suspicious, but you don't want to get involved. It's nothing, you think. Can you be sure?
There was a lot to do.
If you see something, say something. Report suspicious activity to local authorities.
Transportation security, immigration, law enforcement, border protection. It represented the biggest government reorganization in more than half a century. All or part of 22 federal agencies and departments were combined into the new agency. Its job, to keep America safe in a world that had changed in a single day. The War on Terror, which began after the 9/11 terrorist attacks on the United States, escalated in March 2003, when a coalition of American-led forces invaded Iraq. The mission, as stated by President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, was to disarm Iraq of weapons of mass destruction, to end Saddam Hussein's support for terrorism, and to free the Iraqi people.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.